Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Jim Rathmel, professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative and Pain Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'm one of the executive editors for Anesthesiology, and you're listening to an anesthesiology podcast that we've designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in the journal. Today, we're going to talk with the lead author of an original research article and an accompanying editorial view that appear in the November 2019 issue. With us today is Dr. Jose Lodenius. Dr. Lodenius is a senior consultant affiliated with the Department of Pharmacology and Physiology at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. Dr. Lodenius is the first author on an article that appears in the November 2019 issue of the journal, and it's titled Upper Airway Collapsibility During Dexmedetomidine and Propofol Sedation in Healthy Volunteers, a Non-Blinded Randomized Crossover Study. Dr. Lodenius, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me to participate in the podcast. It's a pleasure to attend.
Also with us today is Dr. Denham Ward. Dr. Ward is Professor Emeritus of Anesthesiology and past chair of the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. Dr. Ward wrote an editorial view that accompanies Dr. Lodenius's research article in the November 2019 issue, and it's titled Dexmedetomidine and the Upper Airway, Not as Simple as We Hoped. Dr. Ward, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. I'm looking forward to an interesting discussion.
Dr. Lodenius, congratulations on the publication of your work. I want to start by giving listeners some background. Dexmedetomidine is a sedative that is promoted as having minimal impact on ventilatory drive or upper airway muscle activity. But a recent series of articles have demonstrated impaired ventilatory drive and induction of apnea in volunteers sedated with dexmedetomidine. In the study we're discussing today, your study, you measured upper airway collapsibility during sedation with dexmedetomidine, and you compared that to upper airway collapsibility during sedation with propofol. What was your hypothesis when you started this study?
Well, the hypothesis that we wanted to examine was whether dexmedetomidine would have less effect on upper airway collapsibility than propofol sedation.
You conducted this study in 12 healthy human volunteers. Can you talk us through how the study was done?
Yes. We included adult individuals of ASA class 1 to 2 and a body mass index of less than 37. And these individuals were examined on two separate days, sedated with dexmedetomidine on one day and propofol on the other. They were equipped with standard perioperative monitoring, but also an electroencephalogram and bispectral index score monitoring. Respiratory effort was measured with thoracic and abdominal inductance plethysmography and a pressure transducer catheter passed via the nostril to the esophagus. A nasal mask was applied and the mouth was sealed with tape. Fresh gas was delivered in the nasal mask with a custom-built pressure source, a modified CPAP machine, if you will, that can deliver both positive and negative pressure. A maintenance nasal pressure was given to allow for inspiratory flow without flow limitation. Intravenous sedation was then initiated with a bolus dose of drug given during 10 minutes, and this was followed by a maintenance infusion, aiming for light sedation. We checked the sedation level with clinically used sedation scales and recorded this continuously. After 20 minutes of maintenance infusion, allowing for steady state to occur, pharyngeal critical pressure was measured. And immediately after the first set of measurements, the maintenance infusion was increased to induce deep sedation. Airway measurements were then repeated during deep sedation. Thereafter, the protocol was ended with the first drug, and this was repeated on a second day with the other drug.
All right. So I'm trying to imagine being a volunteer in this study. You studied 12 human volunteers, and you watched. You looked at upper airway collapsibility at infusions rates that produced low and moderate levels of sedation with dexmedetomidine and propofol. Talk us through, in lay terms, exactly how this upper airway collapsibility was measured and what that measurement means.
Well, pharyngeal critical pressure is measured by conducting a series of pressure drops in the nasal mask to induce flow-limited breathing. And then flow and pressure during flow-limited breaths are plotted in a graph. And the pharyngeal critical pressure, the PCRIT, as it is called, is derived from linear regression of this relationship between flow and pressure. And the pressure at which the flow is zero, that is, the airway is totally occluded, is the pharyngeal critical pressure. Now, the higher the pharyngeal critical pressure is, the more prone the upper airway is to collapse. So if the PCRIT, for instance, is above zero, the upper airway will collapse to atmospheric pressure. And we know that the PCRIT during sleep differs between normal individuals, snorers, and individuals with obstructive sleep apnea, with increased values for the latter.
All right, so a measure of the tendency of the upper airway to collapse during sedation. So one of the missing elements in many of the prior studies of dexmedetomidine was some measure of the depth of sedation to correlate with the degree of airway collapsibility or apnea, what have you. How did you determine the depth of sedation during this study? I think you used more than one method.
We did. We measured it with two different sedation scales that are clinically used, one for mainly for healthy volunteers participating in studies, and the other one is widely used in the intensive care units. And we also measured BIS, bispectral index score. And adding to that, we used an encephalogram to make sure that there were no arousals during these flow-limited breaths. So there were several ways of measuring the sedation level.
So what did you find?
Our findings were that we could not show a difference in pharyngeal critical pressure when comparing sedation with these two drugs. The level of sedation during deep sedation did differ somewhat according to the sedation scales and BIS, even though we could not make out a difference in the pharyngeal critical pressure. And we also found that three of the participants had periods of central apnea with both drugs starting during the bolus infusion.
So a wide range of different findings in this small group. Now, I'm going to steal a few questions from Dr. Ward. He sent me some suggestions via email over the weekend. And you were able to use a wider range of subject demographics and characteristics like sex, age, body mass index, Mallampati score than is usually seen in a laboratory study. But with this heterogeneous small group, only 9 patients were analyzed. Subgroup analysis was impossible. In future studies, is there a subgroup that you would want to focus on?
It would have been of interest to analyze by subgroups, since we know that the PCRIT differs during sleep between these different type of subjects, normal subjects, snorers, people with obstructive sleep apnea. So that would have been really interesting to see how they differ. And if you're already prone to airway obstruction, you might be more vulnerable to airway obstruction during sedation. And also, pathology of the airway puts you more at risk, and these people were excluded from the study. But as you say, there was a very small number and a variability within the subjects in the study. So it would have been nice to have a larger number, of course, to study. That would be ideal for the future.
One of your subjects didn't get sedated, and another had too much obstruction to be able to make any of the measurements that you made. To find those extremes in such a small study seems pretty interesting. How should that be followed up in future studies?
Well, the person that could not keep an airway open just from lying down would not be ideal to include in the study, as was found when trying to conduct the protocol with this person. The individual that never got sedated enough is very difficult to foresee. So I guess with a larger number included, you can sort of adjust for some people dropping out that you cannot foresee that they will not be able to follow through with the protocol. But maybe it's not ideal to include individuals with a very high collapsibility of the airway just from lying in a supine position. Maybe changing the body position would be one way of doing it, but traditionally, these examinations are done with the individuals lying supine and in a very controlled manner.
Now, this was a very small number of subjects, and you used a physiologic measurement. Can you talk a little bit about generalizing this to clinical practice? How well do you think the results actually generalize?
From a clinical point of view, I think since we have made observations of both upper airway obstruction and centrally evoked apnea for patient safety reasons, the assumption must be that the results generalize to clinical practice. And also from a former study that we have made when we observed upper airway obstruction during dexmedetomidine and sedation. I think the fact that we allowed for individuals with a varying collapsibility of the upper airway to take part in the study makes interpretation more difficult. But we also have used propofol, which is a drug that is well known to cause upper airway obstruction, as a comparator and found no difference with the two drugs. And the correlation in PCRIT between dexmedetomidine and propofol was actually a strong one. So that sort of strengthens the fact that it might be generalizable to a clinical situation as such.
So some pretty strong hints at generalizability. Dr. Ward, yeah. I want to turn to your editorial view. For listeners, again, the editorial is titled Dexmedetomidine in the Upper Airway, Not as Simple as We Hoped. You do a terrific job of putting this article in perspective. Your editorial begins by telling readers that sedative agents depress ventilation through a variety of actions. Can you talk us through the various ways that sedative hypnotics can depress ventilation?
Sure, Jim. Classically, the sedative hypnotics or the analgesics are tested through their effects on the chemoreflexes. And a previous paper by Dr. Lodinius addressed that, or Dr. Metomidine also. That is, the hypoxia through the cryo body causes an increase in ventilation. And hypercapnia through both the cryo body and the central chemoreceptors increase ventilation. And the sedative hypnotics will decrease that response to hypoxia and hypercapnia. But the upper airway muscles are also sensitive to sedation and hypnotics, and it may not be in the same proportion as their effect on the chemoreflex. And thirdly, many years ago, Ray Fink pointed out to us that there's another effect known as a wakefulness drive, that normally during resting breathing, neither hypoxia or hypercapnia is causing our resting ventilation. But there's another drive that's neurological in origin. And of course, the sedative hypnotics are going to remove that that wakefulness drive, and that's going to cause a decrease in ventilation and most likely an increased propensity to upper airway collapse.
How does Dr. Lodinius's new work expand our understanding of the effects of dexmedetomidine and propofol?
Well, I think, as she just nicely pointed out, the fact that even though it's a small study and obviously heavily instrumented volunteers with their mouths taped shut, which would be quite different than the clinical situation, because they do have the propofol comparator there in the same subjects with their crossover design, they can really show it can have similar effects. And coupled with their previous work, they seem to have the same kinds of effects on all three. And ways in which ventilation can be affected, chemoreflexes, the upper airway, and the wakefulness drive. I also thought it was very interesting, again, small numbers, but in their discussion, she points out that the subjects who had kind of the same effects with both propofol and dexmedetomidine, that is, the subjects that had the most airway obstruction, had the most airway obstruction with both drugs. Perhaps some of this is because of a loss of consciousness in the wakefulness drive, rather than a specific drug receptor brain effect, since these two drugs have very different mechanisms of action.
You were surprised by the wide variation of outcomes that were seen in this small study. Can you say more about what you found surprising?
Well, I think the fact that they include such a wide range of subject characteristics, which is, I think, a wonderful thing to do, even though it obviously makes the study harder to do than a very homogeneous set of subjects. Particularly, the subject not getting sedated, I think, points out one of the limitations of their study as far as its clinical applicability, in that they use fixed doses rather than the clinical way that we would titrate, that we would use in practice. If titration had been used, it would be interesting to see that if subjects that require more of the drug to reach the same level of sedation have more of an effect on the respiratory effect, because the drug concentration levels are going to be higher. And I also found out, perhaps not as surprising, the fact that some subjects really have a hard time laying down and are breathing in a supine position.
You wrote to me over the weekend, and you said this: from a scientific point of view, I'm interested in better understanding a specific drug effect versus the effect that's due to loss of consciousness. Can you explain a little bit more about what you mean? I already hinted at this, but why are you interested in differentiating these two effects? Why is that important?
Well, that really goes back to, as I said, both the work back in the 60s that Ray Fink did and also my mentor, Jay Belleville, did, looking at a drug effect in either natural sleep or sedation, decreased level of consciousness. These two are drugs, I think, are great examples. They're very different receptor profiles and where they act in the brain, yet they have very similar respiratory effects. Are those respiratory effects caused by the drug, or are they caused by the loss of consciousness per se? This is really different than for the opioids, which we know have a very specific opioid receptor depression of ventilation, and one in which we would love to find a strong analgesic that doesn't have this respiratory depression. But the loss of consciousness plus the opioid causes a much more depression in ventilation. So just this loss of consciousness, the loss of the higher levels of the brain modulating the respiratory centers in the brainstem can have a pronounced effect. So maybe we need to find the right drug that gives sedation without respiratory effects, but maybe we won't be able to, because the final common pathway, of course, is the desired efficacy of loss of consciousness.
So loss of consciousness itself has profound effects on ventilation.
Yeah, and it may be different than natural sleep. And loss of consciousness through any kind of drug effect may have a different effect than when somebody falls asleep, and may have some of the same effects. Some of the studies we've been doing in our laboratory have looked at the kind of the slow wave sleep that can occur as an EEG manifestation during sedation.
So what are the clinical implications of these new findings?
As Dr. Lodinus has pointed out, the clinical implications are when you're using a drug or drugs that cause a decrease in consciousness, then that patient, and there may be variation in how much, but that patient is going to be at risk for upper airway obstruction. Not to be too simplistic, but vigilance is important. There's no way that you can just assume that because I'm using dexmedetomidine, there's not going to be the same propensity to upper airway obstruction.
Dr. Lodinus, your work really brings into question the notion that dexmedetomidine produces less respiratory depression at similar levels of sedation when compared to propofol. What's next for you and your research group?
Well, we have nothing for the moment planned regarding dexmedetomidine. The research area I'm in now is more into THRIVE, high flow nasal oxygenation during apnea, so it has sort of shifted towards that way. So nothing at the moment regarding dexmedetomidine, but I'm really anxious. I'm hoping to see some new studies in the future regarding the subject.
Terrific. I hope today's discussion will lead many of you listening to read this new article and the editorial view that appear in the November 2019 issue of Anesthesiology. You can learn more about the effects of dexmedetomidine and propofol on the upper airway. Dr. John Wanderer from Vanderbilt and I also created an infographic that appears in the same issue, and it's titled Safe Sedation Reexamined, comparing the respiratory effects of dexmedetomidine and propofol, where we aim to explain the major findings of this study and compare it to our understanding from previously published study. Dr. Lodinus and Ward, thank you for joining me today and for the terrific explanations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, and thanks to you and John for making that nice infographic. I think that's a real valuable addition.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.